Pseudopod, episode 197, June 4th, 2010. This week's story, Set Down This, by Lavie Tidar. Welcome to Pseudopod, the weekly horror podcast. This week's story comes to us from Lavie Tidar, whose work has appeared on Escapepod and Pseudopod before, and whose novels, especially the Tel Aviv dossier, are well worth your time. The story first saw print in the anthology Phantom in 2009, edited by Sean Wallace and Paul Tremblay, and put out by Prime Books. Your narrator this week is Elan Ressel, whose voice work can be found on voices.com. The link is in the show notes, and if you're looking for voice talent, there are a few better. So click play, because that's what you want to do. After all, it is a true story.
Set Down This by Lavie Tidar. On my brother's computer, a video file shows an American fighter plane pinpointing a group of men in Iraq. "Do it," the pilot says. "Confirmed." 10 seconds to impact. Where the men have been, there is a huge explosion, and black smoke covers the grainy gray streets. "Dude," the pilot says. I have no faces and no names to put to the men. The black smoke must have contained the atoms of their flesh, their bones, though bones are hardy, vaporized sweat, burnt eyebrows and pubic hair and nose hair, unless they used a trimmer as I do. In short, the atoms of their being. Later, I think one could find, lying in the street, a tooth or two, the end of a finger that had somehow survived, fragments of bone, a legless shoe. These men are nothing to me. They are pixels on a screen. A peer-shared digital file uploaded from sources unknown, provenance suspect, whose only note of authenticity is that young pilot's voice when the smoke rises and he says quietly, "Dude." Let us pick a man at random from the video. His name is, let's say, Abu Karim. It means the father of Karim. He had given his son the name, perhaps, in honor of Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, because even men who die in targeted bombings might like basketball. He is 5 feet 10 inches tall. You could say he is short, but he had never felt it. His son is taller than him, and he is proud of it. "My big son," he says. In Arabic, the word is Jabbar. There is an Iraqi footballer, Haidar Abdul-Jabbar Kadim, who plays for Jordan's Al Wydad club. He could have been named for the American basketball player too. We don't know what Abu Karim was doing on that street, with those others, at that time and at that place. Undoubtedly, the military minds behind the strike know, or at least suspect. Perhaps he is a terrorist, fighting the Americans who are trying to liberate Iraq. Perhaps he is a religious zealot, coming out of a radical madrasa with the other students. Perhaps he is a secular socialist, a former member of Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath party. It is impossible to tell from the video, and in any case, his death does not concern us. It is, by its very existence, no longer in the bounds of right or wrong. It merely is. Did the man have hobbies? Did he like to collect stamps, as pedestrian as that may seem? Did he covet the Cape Triangular? Did he receive catalogues in the post from Stanley Gibbons? Was his happiest secret moment his receipt of a mint penny black? Poor countries produce stamps for collectors in more wealthy countries. Following the death of Saddam Hussein, the Iraqi banknotes and stamps bearing his image were already selling at premium on London's Cecil Court. I don't want to make him into a saint, though stamp collectors are hardly that. Let's say Abu Karim is not a nice man. Whatever he was before the circumstances of his life changed, he is no longer that. He is, by implication of the bombing that had taken his life, a man guilty of a charge. Perhaps he killed. Maybe this is not the first time he had escaped an attempt on his life. Another video on my brother's computer is called "The Fastest Man in Iraq." It is filmed from the point of view of a video-equipped guided bomb. It shows the target and the approach, and in the same frame, a man running inhumanly fast to get away before the bomb hits. It's a funny video. It is filed under humor, next to sports bloopers, animals and children. I said he runs inhumanly fast, but now I think inhumanly is not the right word. He runs as fast as he humanly can. It could even be that he is Abu Karim, and that time, he survived. I don't know what he was before. A husband? A parent? A juice seller or a preacher of the Quran or of Marxism? But what had he become? And how? What led to his death, just or otherwise, and his digital rebirth as an extra in an internet movie? Of course I have no answers. Abu Karim is imaginary after all. I can't shout after him, Jibal Awiya, bring your papers, and expect him to present himself with ID and driving license and a passport one can no longer travel anywhere with. I cannot say, Wachef wa ana batuchek, stop or I will shoot, because he is both imaginary and already dead. His ghost recedes away from me when I shout these things. When I try to ask him nicely to let me in, to ease my disquiet, when I say, Iftach ilbab yachmar, open the door, you donkey, he won't answer, and the door to his mind, to his recall, remains closed to me. But more and more, since I had watched my brother's videos, I find myself in that state of this vague disquiet, and when I sleep, I see his face, whole the way it was in life, staring at me with, but I can never tell what that look in his eyes like black olives is. The titles of my brother's videos are these: Airplane F4 Crash, B-52 Crash, F-14A Explosion, you can tell he's into flying, F-16 in Fallujah, F-117 in Action, Hellfire Strike, Renegade Platoon Locates IED in Bakuba, February 2005, Roadside IED, Terrorist Hunting, Warning, A Bit Sick, Worst Kind of Ambush, and so on. Worst Kind of Ambush is another humorous video. We see a row of portable toilets. Two soldiers run at one of the cubicles, knock it down and run away. The door opens to reveal a soldier with his pants down, holding a roll of toilet paper in one hand. Nice ass, a voice off camera says. IED stands for Improvised Explosive Device. It is the sort of charge Iraqi insurgents, those fighting the liberators of their country, set up by the side of the road. For instance, as in fact in the video labeled Roadside IED, where the charge hits an American vehicle. Did Abu Karim help build these IEDs? Did he kill American soldiers? Did he contribute unknowingly to more videos than the one featuring his last performance? As a matter of fact, I suspect these videos do not exist. A Google search for terrorist hunting, warning, a bit sick, shows no results. The video, reminiscent of a screen of a computer game, shows figures running on the ground, and an unnamed American pilot being directed to shoot first one, then another, and later blow up a truck with people inside it. It is unlikely such classified material would be made available on the internet. Therefore, I suspect it, too, is most likely propaganda, though I don't know whose. But back to Abu Karim, or maybe not. Maybe go back rather to Karim, his son. Is he dead? If not, is he too building IEDs? More and more, Abu Karim invades my sleep, materializing in the black moments between sleep and awakening, when I rise with a desperate need for the bathroom. He appears in the grogginess of early morning, before coffee and cigarettes banish him to the world of the dead again. He is my own private IED, improvised and explosive, with a son, a wife, a fruit seller's job, as fanciful as that may be. Everything in short, but a coffin. Why is he bothering me? It is possible, I suppose, that his atoms, blasted, were carried on the wind like sand from the Sahara, halfway across the world, bringing him to me. it is possible I inadvertently inhaled them. It is even possible that my body, in its ceaseless quest of regenerating cells, had used some of those loose atoms to construct some minute part of my own body. Is that what it is? Is Abu Karim a cancer, trying to feed off of me? I want nothing of his. I want him to remain dead. I want him gone. Bomb attack. Bottlehead shot. Die terrorists die. IED attack versus striker. War footage. Iraqi gets lit up. More recently, the voice of Abu Karim has been growing faint, replaced with a voice I have no reason to believe is dead. I call him John. He sounds white, although I am not an expert in American accents. He usually says only one word. It is said with a kind of humorous awe. Dude. Did John go to college? Or did he go straight to the army at 17 or 18? Somehow he sounds to me like a college kid. Dude. Like when you drink beer through a hose, dude? It's called a beer bong. When you drink so much you get seriously bombed. Where did he come from? I know as much about Americans as I know about Iraqis. That is to say, very little. Can John be Karim's age? What movies does he like? What music? Is he a rock music guy? Does he prefer the constant beat of jungle? Who was his first girlfriend? When did he lose his virginity? Has he ever been to Vegas? Different sets of questions, different assumptions. For all I know, Abu Karim was never a fruit seller. Perhaps he was a mechanical or chemical engineer. Perhaps he studied in America before the war. It is possible, I suppose, that he went to the same hypothetical university John went to. Has he been to Vegas? And what did he think of it? Did he hate it? Was he indifferent? Or did he carry the memory of it like a guilty, joyful secret all those years? In those moments between sleep and awakening, they both rise inside me. Their voices speak, but only to me. They won't talk to each other. I beg them to be quiet, but now they are loose. Like a virus they reproduce. They are caught in each other's moment, in an endless digital loop, spreading from one computer to another, from one mind to another, overtly conducting a YouTube war. But I didn't ask for this. I turned off the television. I subscribe to no papers. I listen to music stations on the radio and turn the volume down when the news comes on. In that, I am like most people. I suspect Abu Karim did not care for the news until he found out he was part of it. And John, I think, is just a regular guy with a sweetheart back home and a mother who writes him letters every week and hopes he drinks plenty of water in the heat. Go to them, I say. Go to your mother, your sweetheart, your high school coach, your small town haven. And you, Abu Karim, go to your heaven if you are a believer. And if not, go to the place where us atheists go. Into a nowhere that is everywhere, where our atoms, our quantum, live as long as the universe itself will exist. But go. I shall erase every last copy of you. I shall destroy the software that is able to decode you. I will eradicate all knowledge of the video format that holds you. Go. Go back to your war, and leave me to mine. I do not want your ghosts. The poet Eliot once said that he had seen birth and death, but had thought them different. The Magi return to their kingdoms, but they are no longer at ease there. Frost said that home is where, when you have to go there, they have to let you in. Where will John and Abu Karim go? Can they return to their places, to the old dispensation? And if they did, who would let them in? Do it, the pilot says. Confirmed. 10 seconds to impact. Explosion. Black smoke. A voice says, dude. And nothing more. Were they brought together across half a world for birth or death? Recently I visited the Kruger Park, a place far removed at first glance from the world of explosives, improvised or otherwise. I saw elephants and cheetahs, antelopes and rhinos, but the animals I liked the most were small, black, ungraceful. The dung beetles congregated wherever there was fresh dung. They burrowed inside it. Their arms gripped the fresh, moist, earthy shit and molded it. Diligently, they formed it into balls, some much larger than themselves. Diligently, they rolled the balls across the tarmac and into the bushveld beyond. The dung beetles lay their eggs inside the balls of dung. Their young eat through the compressed excrement, and as they reach the outside at last, they open wings and fly.
I've talked at length several times about William Friedkin's definition of true horror being seeing something approach. It's a perfect distillation of the genre, of the feeling when you realize the calls are coming from inside the house, that the last helicopter has already left, that the killer chasing you cannot possibly be human because you have shot and stabbed and run him over and he is still coming. Click play, seriously, it's awesome. It's not the only definition of horror, and there's plenty of room for other types too, but for me, it's always been the only one that mattered. Until now. Because now it has company. Because, as LaVie makes clear, true horror isn't just seeing something approach. True horror is seeing everything, having every piece of information, every viewpoint, every approach at your fingertips, 24 hours a day. True horror is rolling news coverage. True horror is the camera phone as a witness. True horror is gun camera footage on YouTube. Click play. Everyone else is. We live in information, so much so that it's practically a sixth sense. Everything is at our fingertips. Everything is accessible. Do what thou wilt is not just the whole of the law, but click where thou wilt is. Most of the time, it does nothing but empower us too. Look at WikiLeaks, look at the grassroots movement to reform Parliament over here. Hell, look at the protests against the Digital Economy Bill, which did and continue to do so much more to raise people's awareness than the House of Parliament, where, I might add, a grand total of 15 MPs out of hundreds bothered to turn up to debate it. We're empowered. But in being empowered, we become responsible to watch and listen without prejudice, to help shoulder the weight of the things we see and hear. The information changes us, and we should change the information, give it shape and context, and use it as a tool to make the world a better, smarter, safer place. And you know what? Not enough of us do. As any comment thread on any YouTube video, basically in history, will attest. But that doesn't matter. What matters is you. Is the information you choose to see, the shape you choose to give it, how you react to it. Whether we like it or not, this is a global culture now, one we can access at every level, and that demands a dialogue, it demands an exchange, it demands a response. Or to put it another way, there is no mare in team. Pseudopod is a production of Escape Artists Incorporated and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives License. If you like this story, please go to pseudopod.org and click on Feed the Pod, as we rely on you to pay our authors and cover our costs. And Pseudopod knows none of us travel light. Not anymore.